Welcome back to the second guest show, Mike to Tell You Along with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert, live from the Silver Slipper Casino, these beachside in Hancock County, Mississippi. Bobby J and I will be on until 8 o'clock tonight. We'll remind everybody to this Saturday, 1 to 4, it'll be myself along with the Cajun Cannon and Deuce McAllister. We will be at Rouse's Supermarkets on Chapatula Street. Come on by and visit us. We'll be talking a lot of college football, certainly also some Saints. But with the college football having the full run this weekend and LSU playing USC, we're talking a lot about LSU and their season opener against USC. And we'll have that game live right here on the Big 870 WWL at 6:30. At 2 o'clock, it'll be myself along with Jeff Palermo. Herb Tyler's out in Las Vegas, so he'll be supervising and coordinating on that end of the stick, and it'll be our Tiger tailgating show, and we'll be at Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge. So come on by and join Jeff and I as we give you 2.5 hours of pregame coverage, LSU and USC.
So Mike, what were you doing on Saturday? The pregame?
Yeah,
at Rouse's?
We 1-4 at Rouse's on Chapatulas.
So that's the pre-pregame.
Pre-pregame. And be Deuce, Cannon, myself, will be there talking certainly a lot of college football and some NFL and Saints.
Yeah, thinking about the roster.
But there'll be a lot of roster changes on this football.
That's basically a week before the first game. You have a mini bye right now. And I like the way the NFL does it.
They've handed over the Labor Day weekend to college football.
Yeah, you got it. And Mike, I truly believe that I don't see how they can't. I mean, why wouldn't the fans want this? Now, the players, if you're paying them their salary.
It's going to go 18.
18
Bob.
Games.
Bob, it's gonna
and
be
then.
And you two buys.
Yes, exactly. So I wouldn't be surprised if one day the Super Bowl is not until the end of February. You know what I mean?
You can thank that.
Instead of the beginning, and then you just push everything kind of back. Because right now, the NFL is all 24-7, 12 months out of the year. You might have a lull.
Bob, they king.
The only lull I would say in the NFL, Mike, correct me if you think this is wrong.
June.
I'd say late June to late July. That one, 3 or 4 weeks in that. But other than that, that's when the coaches, everybody's taking a vacation. But the other 11 months, there's always NFL news. There's always, opening camp and this and that, and it's always something. Combine, everything.
In the middle of baseball season where it would get hot, what is dominating the news? Now, we'll talk about some of the LSU players, like with Paul Skeens. Dylan Cruz in his second at-bat, now his first at-bat, he chased a high fastball, popped out, but he reached base. Via a walk, so he got the first base. But then, fielder's choice out, double play.
Oh, wow. So
for the Nationals, I mean, man, we talk about this all the time. Paul Skeens, he got nothing around him.
From a hitting standpoint
with the Pirates. And, now Dylan, you can see why they were picked where they were and who they were with.
Yeah, you look at the Nationals, but you look at the Pirates. And, my youngest son lives in St. Louis, so I've gone to a few Cardinals games. Boy, besides the Brewers, they're all irrelevant. And what I mean by that, if you just look at the standings, I think I want to say the Brewers are 10 games ahead. You look at St. Louis Cardinals. You look at Chicago Cubs. The Cincinnati Reds, Pittsburgh Pirates. Mike, they all kind of mince. They're not. No, the Brewers are the only one that's.
Brewers are it.
Yeah, keeping up with the top teams. So, Paul Skeens, all you could do as a player is just do your job, and you hope you have that support.
Now, you're great when he's great.
Right.
Other than that.
Yeah.
And we'll see. I think the transition, though, for both of these unbelievable players at LSU. And you can say next man up. Come on, the next man, he ain't close to what Paul Skeens is. He's not close to what Dylan Cruz. Come on, that's a reality check.
Well, you have to realize, too, you can be outstanding in college, even outstanding high school player, that they might draft you on potential. You might get drafted really high. But to say you're not in the farm system, you might have to pay your dues and be in the farm system. But once you're a major leaguer, you're a major leaguer. Once, Mike, to say You know what the odds are? You truly making it to the major leagues? Not double A, triple A, but you a major league player. And then if you last, Mike, that's a small fraternity.
Okay. Dion, I remember you telling me this story. Dion says, as far as football, he could do what he wanted to do. In baseball, they just fed me fastballs. I could hit it. But his comment to you was, the hardest thing in sports is
hitting
a baseball.
Hitting major league pitching. Mike, in major league, you're not talking about when he played at Florida State baseball. Dion was telling me, like, football, he don't even need to practice. He can go cover somebody, you know, if he's in shape and all that. And then he looked at even like basketball. Man, I can handle the basketball, do all that. He said, I'm telling you, the hardest thing to me athletic-wise, not you track, I can go run track and be fast or quick or whatever race you're doing. He said, to me, the hardest thing was hitting major league pitching. He says, now, he said, if it's coming 100 miles an hour, I guarantee, Dion told me, if it's coming 100 miles an hour, I could bat 500. Now, if every pitch was 100 miles an hour, but not all
is
of a sudden,
off speed
one
curve
comes in at 98 to 100, the other one's at 82 to 84 and moving. Because that's when it's difficult. That's why, look, Mike, I've said this a number of times. You could be a multi-millionaire. You get paid the big bucks. You only succeed 30% of the time. What if you're batting 300 and hitting major league pitching? Mike, you're going to have a job for a long time.
Okay, you and I talk about this because grew up to watch it. But for people another generation, what Greg Maddux did. Okay.
Oh. The fastest he ever threw a ball was probably 91 or 92 miles an hour.
Because most of his pitches were in the mid-80s at best.
But, Mike, ball placement, he could hit, you know, the bullseye, whether you look at all the four corners over the plate and how you want to how you position the ball to what it's called on the corners, you know, touching the corners. No, he was unbelievable. Mike, and that ball's moving. I'll tell you, Greg Maddux, how that just goes to show you, it's pitching. It's not throwing. It's not throwing smoke or heat. Now, it's good that you could do that. Now, what's really unbelievable is when, Mike, all of a sudden you could throw it 98, 100 miles an hour, and then you could throw some pitch in the 80s that works magic. Then you're really frustrating the hitters.
We had an event at Nichols State, and your old friend of yours, Chipper Jones.
Yeah.
I remember you telling me the story. I said, Chipper, you got to confirm this. I said, Bobby tells me the day that you signed that huge contract, you told him, Bob, I could hit like 155. They got to pay me for the rest of my
$90 million. And now, Mike, you look at all the money you're getting paid now. But it was like, you know, you talk about you hit the lottery in life.
He said, it's true. I told him that.
You know, and like the guarantee is like, you know, Bob, you write your name. And, you know, obviously you have more pride and dignity, so you're going to, and your competitive spirit. So you're not just going out there and half-assing or freelancing. But he goes, you know, if I strike out after strikeout or strikeout or make error after error, you still got to pay me $90 million. That's like winning the lottery, isn't it?
That's a Powerball
yeah,
win.
A
Powerball. Ain't no lottery. That's Powerball.
Yeah, the Powerball. So, yeah, it's just unbelievable if you have that ability to play at that level. And when you sign a contract, even like CeeDee Lamb did today, CeeDee Lamb hit the Powerball finally with Dallas and Jerry Jones. Because, Mike, I don't know what
100 of the 138.
Yeah. So CeeDee Lamb, I think he's amongst the best. He's with Justin Jefferson, one
no
of the
question.
Best receivers. But if all of a sudden he pulls a Deshaun Watson, that's the one that's stealing money, Deshaun Watson with the Cleveland Browns.
A lot
what
of
they
pressure
gave him?
On him.
$235 million.
Guaranteed.
What, he just quit? Did he quit or something? Deshaun Watson, I don't know. He's not good people to me. Does he not have any pride or confidence? Mike, he's stealing money. That's why owners look at that like, well, they look at the Browns. When the hell did y'all do? That's why they don't want to give that much guarantee.
A lot of the owners. Because remember, that was a host of teams after Deshaun Watson.
Well, the Saints were one.
The Saints were one. Atlanta was another. Carolina. But Jimmy Haslam said, okay, the only shot is guarantee him the entire $240 million.
And they did.
And he signed with Cleveland.
And I'm telling you what, and the supporting cast, and Cleveland had the number one defense last year in the whole National Football League. It's all on Deshaun Watson. I'm not on a good team. What? No, you're on an unbelievable team. Now, you put up the numbers. You look to get that payday with the Houston Texans.
When he, what happened afterwards?
Mike, no, it's like not even the same guy. It's like Isaiah Foskey. Is that the same guy that Notre Dame? Or, what have you done lately?
He did it at a high level, at the pro level.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I remember Rick Vinatieri telling me, Mike, our worst nightmare with the coach was having to play against him. That's how many problems he gave the coach.
Deshaun Watson, remember, I think it might have been the first game of the year, Mike. I can't recollect the year, but I think it was the first game against the Saints. Now, he almost brought him back to beat him. He was unbelievable in that game, how he was spinning the ball.
Absolutely.
But, Mike, to him, no. Deshaun Watson, come on, dude. You've been financially rewarded. You got to have some pride and step up because you're on a great team. The Cleveland Browns are on.
Look what Joe Flacco did after he got hurt.
Yes, look what Joe – exactly. Look what Joe Flacco did when he took over. Come on, Deshaun.
When we return to Second Guess, we'll have on with us author Melissa Lutke. Who covered Major League Baseball in the 1970s, her book out, Locker Room Talk, talking about her having to go to court to cover Major League Baseball and also be in the locker room in Major League Baseball locker rooms. We'll have Melissa on right after this break here on the Big 870 WWL. We're back here on the Second Guest Show. Mike DeTeglia along with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert, live from the Silver Slipper Casino, beachside in Hancock County, Mississippi. We'll take the show up to 8 o'clock tonight. On our Oakwood Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line, author of Locker Room Talk, Melissa Lutke. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us. Before we get into the talk about the book a little bit, my understanding is you're going to be at Octavia Books in New Orleans mid-September?
I am. And thanks so much, Bobby and Mike, for having me on. I feel bad about breaking up that conversation about, the hardest thing to do in sports is hitting the baseball, because I still love talking about baseball and I don't get to do it enough. So feel a little bit bad about breaking into that one. But yeah, September 16th, Monday night, I'm going to be at Octavia's Books. I'm going to do a little talk there. Gwen Tompkins. Your own Gwen Tompkins, who does Music Inside Out in New Orleans, is going to moderate the talk with me. And, love for people to come down who love baseball.
You went to court basically against Bowie Kuhn. Now, one thing with Bowie being a commissioner, he wasn't the most progressive guy in the world, even in the 70s, for a lot of things. But I'll let you kind of explain kind of the outlay of this. So one thing with Bowie, you in a long line of people that really didn't care for the way he treated a lot of people in this world.
And, Melissa, like Mike saying, it was Major League Baseball, or was it about the same time? I can remember Sam Weish in the NFL. Was Major League Baseball in the NFL as far as female reporters in the locker room, is that all about the same time, or what's the time frame there?
No, it is about the same time. It's kind of interesting to just jump back like 2 years to the mid-70s, 75. And that's when you had the NHL and the NBA, which were considered the two minor sports. I mean, for people to think of the NBA as a minor sport now is very difficult. But to take oneself back to the 70s, it was. And that's what women mainly covered. You know, at that time, newspapers only wanted one woman, but they did want that one woman so they wouldn't be sued for gender discrimination. And they usually assigned that woman to either the NBA or the NHL. What was odd was that I was assigned by Sports Illustrated, the leading magazine probably in the world for sports, as the baseball reporter. We had a different way of doing things at SI. I was a reporter, not a writer. So the NHL and the NBA had figured out that they had women covering them. They needed to have equal access. They needed to do their jobs. And so the president of the NHL, commissioner of the NBA, literally said, okay, it's time. We have women doing this job. We'll open them up. And it was at that point that the man you're talking about, Bowie Kuhn, we later found out in the discovery phase of our lawsuit against him, that he put in his top drawer a memo to self saying that my policy from here on out is that no woman will ever report in the clubhouse. So essentially he was responding at that point to what was happening with the other leagues and just kind of waiting for a woman like me to come along at the right time. And then he'd pull his memo out and say, well, we have this policy. And in fact, that's what he did in 77 at the World Series.
And when did you bring your lawsuit?
Yeah, it was 77 at the World Series. He banned me from both clubhouses. Really a fate that I'd sealed for myself by playing the sort of mother may I good girl by going to the Dodgers. I'd already gone in and reported in the Yankees locker room. I knew that was going to be fine with them. Went to the Dodgers. Tommy John talked to me. He was the player rep. Took a vote of his players. The players voted with a majority to say, we understand she has a job to do. And it was me going to pay that courtesy call in the Dodgers, because I knew they didn't have a woman covering them, that word got up to the commissioner. And it was then that he banned me. He placed his edict that I wouldn't go into the clubhouses during the World Series. And then he added for special touch after that, or forever, meaning as long as he was commissioner. And at that time, he was a fairly young man. He was 50 years old. So I was looking at, most of my early career, being banned from the place I needed to be to do the work I needed to do for the magazine.
Now, Melissa,
we took him to court. We took him to court. To answer your question, we took him to court, filed a gender discrimination complaint with the federal court in the end of December 1977. And by 1978, we were in the federal court at the hearing, and the decision came down the following September. So it was about a year.
Melissa, how do you feel being like laying the foundation and being a trendsetter? Because today, this day and age, every NFL team or you look different professional teams, they have a number of female sports writers that have the same access as a male reporter. You have to feel pretty special about that.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, it's taken time. It has taken time. Even after the order came down from the judge Constance Baker Motley in the Southern District Court of Manhattan about my access at Yankee Stadium. That was her purview. It still took 6 years. And a change of commissioner. Bowie Kuhn was right. It did take the change of commissioner for Peter Ueberroth to come in, take over for Kuhn, and go to a press conference and issue a press release saying, from now on out, it's not just up to the clubs to do it. It's a mandated policy of Major League Baseball. So that took a while. And then, I found out, the older I've gotten, the more I've understood that to have changed the law, to have gone into court with a skilled attorney and changed the law based on the equal rights, equal protection clause, of our Constitution, turned out to be the easy part. The law was much easier than changing the attitudes. But I think you're exactly right. I think it was it Bobby or Mike who just said that. Today, you've got women doing this job and having equal access. We don't read about it. We don't hear about it because it just works. It works as we knew it would work back then, because it was really never about nudity. I mean, baseball wanted to make it a moral case instead of a legal case for equal rights. They made it a moral case and they lost in the court of law. But those attitudes remained for a while. So now we're almost 50 years, after my case. I'm writing this book now at a time where, your granddaughters, Bobby, Alice and Magnolia are going to grow up being able to play any sport they want because of Title IX. They're going to have the ability to play sports that I didn't have, when I was growing up. My generation certainly didn't have. And we're seeing the result of this, both in terms of the women having access to tell the stories, but also for girls and women to grow up playing sports. And look what happened just in the Olympics. Look what happened with the the Women's Soccer League this week. They've gone back to collective bargaining and won the best contract that any team, men's or women's, has ever won in the history of collective bargaining. So there is incredible momentum. I mean, look at the WNBA with Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. So, we are seeing an explosion, but we're also seeing it, you're right, in the number of women who are doing the broadcasts. They're up in the booths now, and the number of women who are out there covering the teams. It's a change.
Now, Melissa, I think, I don't know if you take my approach, but I have common sense. I think the Olympic Committee, they kind of missed the boat. because it's all about trying to promote the sport international. How could Caitlin Clark not be on the Olympic team? I mean, you know that the United States is still going to win. I don't know. I think eyes that watch, you might say, oh, she has to pay her dues. I mean, I don't know. I'm a capitalist in this regard. I don't know. She's a hot hand. So why not give her that opportunity to help support the sport? I mean, what was your take on that?
She's absolutely a hot hand. And, you know, Christine Brennan, a fabulous columnist with USA Today, took that point of view early on, argued it. And I think even when she saw the Olympic team playing and winning the gold medal over there, she still said Caitlin Clark should have been on that team. And I believe Dawn Staley agreed in an interview over in France that, you know, were the decision to be made again, were it to be made now, surely she should have been on that team. I think that what we're dealing with is a little bit maybe like I was dealing with. We're dealing with tradition. And the tradition is that the players that earn the right to be on that Olympic squad are ones that have been on it before, who have worked their way up, who have paid their dues over time. You know, I'm not in the inner circles of the people who made that decision, but I was rather surprised. I was shocked, actually, that she wasn't on the team. But, you know, she's had an extraordinary season, and she's only proven herself time and time and time again to the point where anyone who would look at her season would say it's been a very unusual rookie season for a WNBA player. She's an exception. She set the record on assists, et cetera. So I'm on your side on this one. I couldn't take a different point of view.
Melissa, from an NFL perspective, I can remember, I just mentioned his name, and he's passed away since, but it was dealing with the nudity part of Sam Weiss with the Bengals. Oh, we can't have no female reporters
there. Yeah. There's a very famous video of him standing outside. I think he's wearing a wig or something and pretending he's a woman or something. Maybe I have him confused, but it was definitely, he made a scene about it over and over again. You know, eventually things calmed down. The media circus left town and, you know, people went about doing their work. And it turned out that it worked. I mean, have there been problems? Yes. Lisa Olson would tell you that there was a terrific problem in the Patriots clubhouse when a few players decided to exhibit themselves to her and make fun of her. And the owner decided to literally bully her out of the country, leading the fans against her and turning people against her. But again, that's an age-old tactic, you know, to turn the woman into some kind of sexual object, berate her. You know, back in the day, the cartoonist had a great field day with me, or the personification of me. You know, I was extremely buxom in those cartoons. And in reality, I had almost no cleavage, and whatever cleavage I had, I did my best to bring it in and hide it when I went on the job up to the ballpark, because I knew then that I had to be careful in terms of how I dressed. I had to be careful in terms of, you know, how I just acted, you know, around the men. I had to be on my best behavior. And I had to be on my toes in terms of really being smart in the kind of questions I asked, because, you know, the eyes and the ears were on me. And I would easily become the butt of jokes if I made some mistakes. I mean, as women find today in the broadcast booth, they make an error in their what they say, and it's as though, you know, we've had a global summit that has fallen apart in some way. You know, and a man makes an error. I mean, we all make mistakes, and it seems to be able to blow over. So we're still dealing with attitudes. There's no question about it, but we're getting there.
You know, Melissa, the one thing, you know, like progression and how you go forward, just look at number of not only the NBA, but the NFL. You have a number of female coaches at the highest level. We just had an article here in the Advocate and Picayune, and the young lady from Newman who's coaching with the Ravens
today.
So you analyze, you know, everyone's breaking it down. So it's wide open. I think we have progressed in the right direction, where if you want to go in that field, and whether it be the NBA or whether it be the NFL, I'm not inclined maybe to know anything more about the Major League Baseball, But it seems like if no matter what your sex, that if that's your interest and you have the ability, that you have an opportunity. I think we definitely that has occurred as of late.
No, absolutely. The opportunities are there. I mean, the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, we've seen a number of firsts in hires that have been made. I mean, we saw Kim Ng be hired by the Marlins as the first general manager, you know, in baseball. But then you have to ask yourself, why did she end up leaving after 2 years? Why did the Marlins feel they needed to, after she'd done a hell of a job, by the way, gotten them into the playoffs, and why did they then decide that they were going to bring a man in who she was going to have to report to over her, and she ended up leaving? You know, I've looked at some of the people who have gotten these jobs, these coaching jobs. Red Sox, you know, always the last team up here to do anything progressive, actually had hired two women as coaches, one with the major league team, one with one of their minor league teams up in Portland, Maine. This was 2 years ago. They ballyhooed, you know, them coming in. 2 years later, they're both gone. And one of them kind of refused to talk about it because she didn't want to, you know, make the organization look bad. So I think it's beyond just the headline of when the women arrive. It's how does it work out, you know, and can they bring in more than one? When you're the only woman, you know, try it sometime being the only man in a sea of women. It's not easy, you know, when you are the only. And so, you know, it behooves all of these teams and the rest to get beyond just the first and move it along. And you're right. In some cases, we're seeing it move beyond the first. And I'm the first one to applaud and say, great, that's going to be a help for those women who are there to have others with them.
Melissa, my grandpa, he passed away in his 90s, but he was in his 80s. This is a man who grew up on the bayou, okay? And he made this comment to me because he loved Major League Baseball. And he said three things really sunk the boat of Major League Baseball. He said, one, the transition from people listening to it on the radio to TV. He said, that's one. Two, Marvin Miller. He said, one of the things Marvin did, he got free agency when everybody was battling him. And he said they could not overcome the third one. The worst commissioner ever in Major League Baseball, Bowie Kuhn. Now, this is coming from an 80-year-old man telling me this, who grew up, you know, when you know, listening to Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and he takes it all this thing. And I think he's right to a certain extent, the transition part from radio to TV. That's when football caught him. Marvin Miller certainly changed the landscape across pro sports, not only in baseball, but in pro sports. But Kuhn and how he handled things like somebody that was living back in the 1920s.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, he admitted it. He admitted it in ways. He was a man very much of his time. He'd gone to all-male Princeton University. He'd gone to the University of Virginia School when it was all-male. He'd immediately gone and worked in a white shoe law firm where the only thing women did was, you know, make Xerox copies and place phone calls. So at least as I look at it from the gender perspective, he was living in a different era. And he always put it on baseball. He said baseball is a conservative sport. It was the family-friendly sport. That's what he put it on. He said he was protecting his players' sexual privacy, whatever that meant. And, you know, he had defeated Charlie Finley in court the year before my case. He defeated Curt Flood and sent Curt Flood to a really very, very distressing and depressing end of his life because of Curt's fight against him for free agency, which Marvin obviously picked up and was able to win through the collective bargaining, et cetera. But your grandfather had a wisdom of the years. He was really, I think he'll go down in history as really one of the worst commissioners. His decision to fight me, I don't know. Someone said to me the other day after reading my book, do you think he actually thought that he was going to win? Do you think that the lawyers, because I really focus in on the lawyers who represented him and what happened in the hearing in this sort of battle over equal rights versus the sexual privacy of the players. That's what it came down to. And, you know, if he'd gone to a couple more classes at the University of Virginia, he would have learned, for example, you know, that separate was not equal. That was a decision, a landmark decision by the Supreme Court. He thought that providing separate accommodations for me would represent equal treatment. He was wrong on that. I think he was wrong, too, in his notion that baseball couldn't adjust, that its fans would find this situation of me and other women doing interviews in the locker room, you know, simply against their moral values. I mean, morality. He was as though he was trying to watch out for my morality. He never once spoke to one player. That is documented in this, in setting his policy. So he's all the time claimed he was protecting the players, but really what he was doing in many ways was just using his authority that he was given, and that was a huge authority given to the baseball commissioner, still is, to really be, present his view. I mean, he was also in charge of the Little League and sports in his hometown in New Jersey where his kids played. And a woman who grew up in those years told me about what it was like to have the sports run by Bowie Kuhn in her town. In other words, the boys got to play all of the sports. They got the fields, et cetera. They got the trophies. Her brothers walked home with the trophies. The girls were lucky to get a field to play on or a pool to swim in. So his views were what they were. It wasn't just him as commissioner. It was his views. And he played them out to the bitter end, and he lost. And this was really the only case he ever lost in court. But I think you're right. In the court of, you know, judgment about his term as commissioner, I think history ought to look back and say that it was a failed term as commissioner. He is in the Hall of Fame. But
he started, Melissa, baseball was still number one in America.
I agree.
Number one sport.
Yes.
But it wasn't America's passion.
No.
And you know, Melissa, the problems you've had, you know, with the boy Cone, that reminds me of
Bobby had him too.
I had him with Jim Finks, who almost became the NFL commissioner. I was like, I don't have a contract. How can you own me? That's un-American. I don't have a contract. How can you own me? Come on.
You got it. Yeah.
Melissa.
Well, you know, I spend a lot of time in my book talking about Bowie Kuhn and about, I think, the errors he made in his own judgment about moving ahead with this lawsuit. But he did it. He was full on board. He took it to an appellate court. He just refused to accept the decision, refused to accept that he could lose. But he did. Lose he did, and win we did, and you see the results happening today.
Melissa, thanks so much for joining us. Fascinating subject, and the book is out, Locker Room Talk, and you'll be at Octavia Books in New Orleans September 16th.
That's exactly right, 7 to 8 o'clock, and I welcome everyone to come and tell your neighbors.
All right, thank you, Melissa.
Thanks so much, Melissa. Appreciate it.
You guys are great. Thanks so much for your time. Take care.
Right. Okay. Melissa Luedtke, who came out with the book, covered Major League Baseball for Sports Illustrated. Okay, you think about Sports Illustrated, Bob, in the 1970s.
No, 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, that was the top dog.
You were the woof-woof, so to speak, when you were a writer and a reporter for Sports Illustrated. And she'll be at Octavia Books September 16th. We'll be back to finish it off here on Second Guess right after this break. Welcome back to the Second Guess Show. Mike Dettelia along with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert. We're live at the Silver Slipper Casino. Beachside right here in Hancock County, Mississippi. We had some people ask, 1-4 Saturday, myself along with the Cajun Cannon, Deuce McAllister, will be at Rouse's Supermarkets on Chapatula Street, sort of a pre-game show for LSU-USC. And then Sunday, we start at 2 o'clock, myself along with Jeff Palermo, will be at Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge, 2 to 4:30, and then we'll throw it to the LSU pregame show, 6:30, USC, LSU. Bob, man, it's the longest wait for any sport is when college football and pro football starts back up.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think LSU fans are a little nervous. You know why they're a little nervous?
Because what's happened the last couple of years.
No, 4 years. you know, they have not. We can't go five straight seasons not winning the opener. Because you know what? You want to be in the postseason. Now it's expanded to 12 games. No, I think truly if LSU lives up to their potential, they should be undefeated going into the Ole Miss game. What'd that be, six,
and
seven
And the same
wins?
With Ole Miss. If they live up to their potential.
Yeah, no, thinking of hype with that. No, that's why we love it. We love it.
It's a long wait, but we enjoy it when it's here.
Controlled violence. That's why I always say tackle football. That's why I'll never embrace flag football, because it's not controlled violence. What's violent about flag football? Yeah, you have a skill set, but I think we, the old gladiator mentality, we like tackling. And you knock a snot bubble now and then.
We'll be back to finish it off here on the second guest show right after this break here on the Big 870 WWL. We're finishing up here on the second guest show. Mike DeTellier along with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, every NFL team has to be down to 53. The next day you can sign up to 17 practice squad players. And, Bob, I think you can see a lot of movement across the NFL and here with the Saints also.
Well, you know, when I look at a normal schedule, when you say you're playing Sunday to Sunday, now they play, you know, Monday Night Football and all that. But if you look at Sunday to Sunday, and you know when I'm going to look at the roster is going to be solid. Not tomorrow, but the following Tuesday. Because that's the player's day off. You know how you got that week?
I agree.
I'm telling you, there's a lot that can happen between tonight, which is Monday night, Mike. So that's over a week. So let's say about a week. The next week, even though you're on that 53-man roster tomorrow.
That don't mean you're going to be there the following week.
We might call your girlfriend or your wife or your mom and dad, oh, made the team. Maybe not. You might be on the team for 24, 48 hours. Then, we get somebody else. No, Mike, it's going to be very fluid over the next week.
Bob, end it for us tonight.
All right. Bon nuit, les gens. Good night, people. Who that? Go Saints!
Welcome back to the second guest show. Mike DeTellier along with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert. We're live at the Silver Slipper Casino beachside right here in Hancock County, Mississippi. We had some people ask. 1-4 Saturday, myself along with the Cajun Cannon, Deuce McAllister, will be at Rouse's Supermarkets on Chapatula Street. Sort of a pre-game show for LSU-USC. And then Sunday, we start at 2 o'clock. Myself along with Jeff Palermo will be at Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge, 2 to 4:30, and then we'll throw it to the LSU pregame show, 6:30, USC-LSU. Bob, man, it's the longest wait for any sport is when college football and pro football starts back up.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think LSU fans are a little nervous. You know why they're a little nervous?
Because what's happened the last couple of years.
No, 4 years. you know, they have not. We can't go five straight seasons not winning the opener. Because you know what? You want to be in the postseason. Now it's expanded to 12 games. No, I think truly if LSU lives up to their potential, they should be undefeated going into the Ole Miss game. What'd that be, six, seven
wins?
And
the same with Ole Miss. If they live up to their potential.
Yeah, no, thinking of hype with that. No, that's why we love it. We love it.
It's a long wait, but we enjoy it when it's here.
Controlled violence. That's why I always say tackle football. That's why I'll never embrace flag football, because it's not controlled violence. What's violent about flag football? Yeah, you have a skill set, but I think we, the old gladiator mentality, we like tackling. And you knock a snot bubble now and then.
We'll be back to finish it off here on the second guest show right after this break here on the Big 870 WWL. We're finishing up here on the second guest show. Mike DeTellier along with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, every NFL team has to be down to 53. The next day you can sign up to 17 practice squad players. And, Bob, I think you can see a lot of movement across the NFL and here with the Saints also.
Well, you know, when I look at a normal schedule, when you say you're playing Sunday to Sunday, now they play, you know, Monday Night Football and all that. But if you look at Sunday to Sunday, and you know when I'm going to look at the roster, is going to be solid. Not tomorrow, but the following Tuesday. Because that's the player's day off. You know how you got that week?
I agree.
I'm telling you, there's a lot that can happen between tonight, which is Monday night, Mike. So that's over a week. So let's say about a week. The next week, even though you're on that 53-man roster tomorrow.
That don't mean you're going to be there the following week.
We might call your girlfriend or your wife or your mom and dad, oh, made the team. Maybe not. You might be on the team for 24, 48 hours. Then, oh, we get somebody else. No, Mike, it's going to be very fluid over the next week.
Bob, end it for us tonight.
All right. Bon nuit, les gens. Good night, people. Who that? Go, Saints!